Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Point Man by Chief James Watson and Kevin Dockery. Narrated by David DeVries. Chapter 1. Bright Light. Here it was, a POW rescue operation. These ops were so important that the High Command had given them their own code name, Bright Light. And my SEAL platoon was going in on the first bright light operation of the Vietnam War. As the lead helicopter of our assault group came close to the ground, John Porter and I were just getting ready to jump out when the door gunner and crew chief grabbed us. "No!" they shouted. I looked to the pilot in the right-hand seat just in time to see him pull all the way up on the collective while turning the throttle to full open. He was trying to get the bird up and out of there, and the chopper wasn't moving. All I heard at the time was the fading scream of the turbine slowing to a stop. We had lost the engine. We were taking fire from the ground. I saw the pilot slap the stick over to the side. He was trying to put the bird in on her side so that the blades wouldn't slice us into chopped meat when we bailed out. If we went in straight, it would be a toss-up whether the engine and transmission coming through the roof would crush us before the blades had a chance at us. Below us was double canopy jungle. We had overshot the insertion point. "Holy shit, we're gonna crash," I thought to myself. "We're gonna plow into the ground, burn, and die. What the hell did I get myself into this time?" Though I didn't know it until later, when the pilot turned the chopper on her side, Fuchs, our native interpreter, fell out of the bird. Because we were so close to the ground, Fuchs wasn't hurt when he landed. He had a small Instamatic camera in his shirt pocket and actually snapped some pictures of the crash. There wasn't time for more than a moment's thought when wham! We were into the ground. The chopper went in on her right side, plowing through the trees and into the jungle floor. Blades snapped as they sliced into the rotting vegetation that covered the ground. Metal groaned as it bent and screamed as it tore. We were all tossed around like gravel in a cement mixer. Finally, the stricken bird came to a stop. The sharp odor of fuel leaking from ruptured lines overwhelmed the normal stench of the jungle. Miraculously, nobody was hurt in the crash. We were all shook up, but even the right-hand door gunner got out with much more than a banging up. We had to sort out the tangled mess of men and the dead chopper and scramble out and away from the downed bird before she caught fire. Quickly organizing the team away from the helicopter, I took stock of our situation. I was running very light in terms of weapons. I only had a .45 automatic pistol and the radio on my back. Originally, I had figured I would be too busy on the radio to worry about a shotgun. A radio is the biggest gun a man can carry, because with it, you can call in all the available fire support, and I almost always carried my own radio. John was right there at my side with his Stoner-like machine gun at the ready when we all scrambled out of the crippled bird. After we were safely on the ground, I understood the situation a little more clearly. I had a pilot, co-pilot, two door gunners, Fuchs, the prisoner, John, and several VNs on my hands, most of them even more scared than I was, if that was possible. I had never been in a crash before. We needed to get away from the downed bird as quickly as we could. I had no idea if there would be a fire or not. After putting some distance between ourselves and the crash, I could see that the next thing I had to do was calm everyone down a little bit. We were deep into Jap country, and the natives had already proved themselves restless. A legacy from the UDT of World War II, enemies in Asia were Japs. The co-pilot, who was Vietnamese, had left his weapon back in the bird and was really shook about not being armed. "John, stay in my pocket," I said to Porter as I handed the VN my pistol. That made the VN smile a bit, and then I turned my attention to the pilot. "Sir," I said, "if you had to get shot down, you just got shot down with the best in the world. We're going to get you all out of here. I don't give a damn if we have to walk for a week. I'm getting you out of this. You have no problem. We just don't need you getting excited. Just do as I tell you, move when I tell you, and we're going to be all right. We've survived this, and we can get out." The two door gunners were all ears and listened to my every word. The only weapon they could have reached was a 50-caliber machine gun mounted in the left door, and there was no way we were going to take that. The M60 that had been in the right door was buried under the bird. The VNs could all speak a little English, and I had succeeded in getting everyone calmed down. Now, if only someone would give me a pep talk. The clearing where we were supposed to land was, I thought, to our north. I took a fast compass sighting and pointed. "John, that way. Go." I had no idea whether the bird would explode if we threw a grenade or Mark 13 signal flare into it. Anyway, I wanted to get away and call in my air support. I had all the air cover in the world at my disposal. My plan was to get away from the bird and call the guns in to bust it. That thought kept me from worrying about leaving weapons behind for Charlie to recover. What I was thinking about was moving as fast as we could to get away from the area and to a clearing where they could pick us up. If we couldn't get out, maybe if we could get to the original landing zone, or LZ, we had been going to use, I could bring in the rest of the team and still complete the mission. The radio was my big gun, and that was most important to me right now. Only the radio wasn't working. Jesus Christ, I thought, of all the times for the radio to quit working. It had probably been damaged when we crashed. The only casualty of the bunch, and it had to be the radio. I grabbed John, who was just in front of me. "John, check this out," I said quietly, and I bent over in front of him so he could see the top of the radio. "The damn thing's off, Chief," John said, turning the control switch to the on position. I was too relieved to feel foolish just then. It must have gotten switched off during the crash, I thought, as I put the headset to my mouth. "Bird down, bird down," I heard over the headset. "No smoke, I see no smoke. Abort, abort the operation, abort." All sorts of stuff was flying through the air as I came into the net. "Break, break, this is Whiskey Sour, this is Whiskey Sour, we're down and we're out. Everyone's okay." I wasn't going to tell them what direction I was heading in. Charlie had radios too. "When I get farther away, I will identify with a night end of a Mark 13. I did not want to pop smoke. It would linger in the area, and Charlie would know where we were. "Bust the bird, we're out of it. I repeat, bust the bird. We couldn't take the gear with us." I didn't want to come right out and say weapons, but Charlie wasn't that stupid. He could figure out what I was talking about if he was listening. There was sporadic gunfire coming from the direction of the camp to our rear, but we weren't paying any attention to it. I expect we really shook things up at that POW camp. Everybody there seemed to be firing in all directions, but we couldn't hear anything whistling by our heads. The VC were reconning by fire, shooting in the hopes of our shooting back. But none of my men got trigger-happy, not even the VNs. Fire discipline was important, and our training stuck with us. With none of the fire coming near us, we were able to keep moving. After we had moved some distance, I popped the night flare end of a Mark 13 and called up to the circling aircraft. "Do you identify me?" I called into the radio. They answered back that they did. Now those aircraft could see the situation one hell of a lot better than I could. I called up to them to vector me into the break in the canopy. "Okay, you see us," I transmitted. "What direction do I go for the nearest clearing?" They told me, and we moved out. "John, that way," I said, pointing. We reached the clearing. John covered us with his stoner, while Fuchs and I cut down some small trees and bushes with our knives, enlarging the cleared area enough for a helicopter to land fully. The other people from the chopper stayed under the cover of the trees. While we were working on the clearing, John moved through the bush, securing the area. He was facing VC just by himself, with only his stoner for support. If we were discovered or started taking direct fire, John was ready to lead the enemy off after him. He would sacrifice himself to protect the team. Later, I put John in for the Silver Star for those actions. He got it. As soon as we had cleared the area, I got back on the radio. I had a CNC, command and control bird, on the net. "All right," I called. "We're ready for extraction. We have the LZ secured. Come in and take out your pilot and crew. We will remain behind and cover the extraction in and out, then come back for us. Send me one of your best pilots. It's a very tight LZ. Well, that really rattled somebody's cage up there. How do you know what's needed? Came over the radio, along with a bunch of other garbage. Apparently, there was a full bird colonel in the CNC chopper, and he was not going to take advice from a lowly Navy chief. I do not need this right now, I thought as I answered him. Thinking fast, I came up with something I figured would impress an Army officer. The Army believes in its Rangers, and its Rangers are good. I had been one of the first SEALs to attend Ranger School back in 1965, and had graduated as the top NCO of Class 7. For everyone's information, I transmitted, I am Army Ranger qualified. I went to your Ranger School. Watch me when you come in. I will watch the tail rotor and ground guide the craft. Tell the pilot to watch me and I will keep his tail rotor out of trouble. In a tight LZ, if the pilot lets his tail rotor get snarled, he goes down fast. I did not want any more company with me on the ground. Ranger School had taught me how to guide a chopper in and which signals to use. Apparently, that satisfied the Army. In came the chopper, and it extracted the first bird's crew without incident. Well, almost without incident. The Viet Cong prisoner who had been acting as our guide on the operation hadn't been giving us any trouble. If Charlie was to catch him in our company, he would be executed immediately for talking. As our pilot and crew moved out to the extraction bird, off went the prisoner straight to the chopper. Fuchs and John wanted to drill the guy right there, but I told them not to. I was so relieved the situation hadn't gotten any worse that I was able to be a little generous. No, let him go, I said. It wasn't his fault. He did his job. The chopper took off with the first extraction. Now there were only John, Fuchs, me, and about six of Father Hoa's Vietnamese mercenaries left in the clearing. John came up to me and spoke softly so none of the others could hear. Jim, he said, if you ever let me talk you into changing your mind again, I'll kill you. According to my original plan, John was supposed to have been in the second bird, not in the first with me. But he had argued his way aboard the first bird before the operation started. Everyone was staying cool. We had arrived at an extraction site, and all we had to do was wait for another chopper to come in and pick us up. Father Hoa's people were just standing by. We had earned the trust of these men many times in the past, and they knew we wouldn't be leaving them now. Now we started noticing rounds zipping by. The pop-zip of small arms fire was starting to get close. I got back on the radio and began directing gunships to fire on the targets around our position. We did not want to do any shooting. We let the gunships take care of that for us. Saturate north of me. Saturate northeast of me. There is gunfire on my position coming from there, I radioed to the circling gunships. Overhead were Cobras, Army gunships, Black Ponies, Sea Wolves, every kind of air support imaginable waiting to assist us. A man couldn't have asked for more. They were not actually circling our position. Charlie still didn't know where we were, but if he saw a bunch of gunships circling a patch of jungle, he would quickly figure there was something in the center of the circle the gunships were protecting. But all that flying hardware stayed real close by to where we were. Then that officer in the CNC ship came back on the net. Whiskey sour, calm down. You aren't getting shot at. That really popped my cork. Who was this jerk? How the fuck would you know? I snarled into the radio. You're up there at about 4,000 feet by now, for Christ's sake. Well, you just hang loose there, Whiskey Sour. We have some decisions to make up here. We'll get you out. Oh, great, I thought. They had some decisions to make. I hoped Charlie would give them all the time they'd need to straighten out their pointy little heads. Meanwhile, I had some men to take care of. I reassured everyone that things were going fine. John noticed something was going on as I quietly flexed my hands, imagining them around a certain officer's throat. I had never thrown a prisoner from a chopper, but I would have liked to see that colonel's wings work. They made us wait in that stinking jungle for several hours while they made their decisions. The CNC bird came back on the radio. He wanted me to go back to the downed aircraft. You have got to be shitting me, I answered. You didn't bust it? By this time, Charlie would have built a jungle workshop on the site. Didn't you hear me? There was gear on that bird. No, that's not important. We want you to go back and secure the bird so we can hook it out. They wanted us to go back through a jungle where Charlie was already looking for us and secure the area? This dimwit colonel wanted to bring in a big slow cargo chopper and lift the wreck out with a hook. Who was this man? And where did he think we were? Fort Hood, Texas? Fuck you! I don't know the way you were trained in your army, but we know different. All my training says that if you're shot down in a hostile area, get as far away from the bird as you can as quickly as possible. And if you think I'm going back to that bird, you're crazy. There are probably VC all over it by now, getting whatever was in it out of it. That really made the colonel hot. I'm giving you a direct order, he said. Go back and secure the bird. I don't give a shit what you say. I am not taking my men back through that jungle just so you can save a dead bird. We will walk out if we have to, and if we do walk out of here, I will find out who you are and where you are. After a while, one of the circling Cobra gunships came onto the net. Whiskey Sour, on behalf of the United States Army and especially us pilots, number one, I want to thank you for getting our people out. Number two, I want to apologize for the assholes who are leaving you down there. Immediately, the CNC ship came up on the net. Who is that? Who is that? What's your call sign? Identify yourself. To repeat Whiskey Sour's earlier remark, fuck you! Whiskey Sour, regardless of what happens, I will not leave you, and neither will most of the other gunships. You got our people out. And the airways were clear. Well, then things started happening. They came in and got us without any more garbage about hooking out the bird. And after all that, I never did find out if they busted it. I didn't see or hear it go while we were on the ground. But the way things were happening, I couldn't have cared less. Getting my people out of there was my primary concern. I did find out what the colonel had wanted to do. He was trying to prove pilot error caused the crash. When something goes wrong, the higher echelon wants to hang somebody. That colonel did not believe that we had been shot down. That officious bastard figured that the pilot had done something wrong and had a flame out. If they had pulled the bird out and it hadn't had any bullet holes in it, they could have nailed the pilot. It wasn't until much later, when the platoon was back at Little Creek, that I learned we had the evidence all along, because Fuchs had taken pictures of the crash. All over the underside of the aircraft were plainly visible bullet holes. So much for the colonel's flame out. As it turned out, some good did result from the operation. When we hit the area, the guards at the camp went absolutely shithouse. In the confusion, about 20 VNPOWs were able to get away. But we never did find out about any Americans who might have been in that camp. Duke Leonard came over and threw his arms around me. Chief, he said, Chuck almost shot that other pilot because of what happened. What are you talking about, Duke? I asked. And where is Chuck anyway? He's over in the ammo locker counting bullets, Duke said. He expects the shore patrol to come along any minute and drag him away to a court-martial. Remembering my own lack of military courtesy to a certain colonel in a CNC bird, I started wondering. What court-martial? Just what the hell are you talking about, Duke? I asked. It was then that I learned what had happened in the second bird. 8 of the 10 helicopters in my assault group had one SEAL from my platoon on board. The SEAL would be leading a group of Father Waugh's people who were on the chopper with him. The first two birds each had 2 SEALs on board to provide intermediate extra leadership on the ground. Duke and Chuck had been the 2 SEALs on the second bird. The door gunner had spotted some people moving around on the ground just before you went in, Duke said. He wanted to take them under fire, and there wasn't anything I could do to talk him out of it, so I did the next best thing. My stoner was pointed in his direction, and I told him that if he opened fire, so would I. Chuck was up in the cockpit, and he saw you go down. Since I was in back, I couldn't see what the hell was going on. Besides, I had my hands full with the door gunner. The pilot told Chuck, "We've aborted. The lead bird went in." "Then that son of a bitch was going to leave you, Jim," Duke said. "Only he didn't recon with fellers." Chuck told him, "That's my chief down there. We aren't going to leave him there alone." "Then to help me, Jim," Chuck took his stoner and laid the barrel up against the pilot's head. Then the co-pilot took his .45 and put it up to Chuck's head. We had a Mexican standoff right there in the cockpit of a Huey. "Since I was busy with the door gunner, I couldn't back Chuck," Duke continued. "The pilot was trying to tell Chuck that the rest of the flight and support teams were backing you up, but we couldn't see what was going on with the other birds." Chuck finally let the pilot go back to the field. But I don't think that VN co-pilot took his eyes off of Chuck for 1 second during the return flight. All Chuck had wanted to do was get in close enough so we could jump out and back you up. Right now, he's figuring that pilot's going to have him charged with assaulting a superior officer or something. As it turned out, the pilot never tried to have Chuck charged. All the SEALs are good men. Some just excel a little bit more than the others. When you have gone through as much as we had, just getting through training, you become very close with your teammates. The guys in the other birds just knew that the mission had been aborted. They didn't know that I had been shot down until they were back at the LZ. Only Chuck actually saw me go down. Otherwise, the stories in the other birds might have been a lot different. Chapter 2. Home and Hearth. I have been a professional military man for most of my adult life. Even my earliest memories revolved around war. I was born in 1937, and so was too young to remember the beginning of World War II, but my whole life centered around my family's reactions to it. My father had been a mechanic for a bus company in New Jersey during 1941 and 42. As the country geared up for defense production, Dad moved the family to Pennsylvania. We stayed with my grandparents in Sharon Hill on the outskirts of Philadelphia, along with most of the rest of the family. My grandparents had a large three-story house with pillars on the front porch. The porch wrapped most of the way around the building. We played on that huge porch during the summer. It seemed like the whole family had moved in with Grandma and Grandpa. Uncle Buck and Aunt Mary were there along with their two sons, Jimmy and Skip, and my Aunt Pearl and Aunt Chick, just kids at the time, and Mom and Dad, my little brother Bob, and myself. Dad had become the head test driver at the Baldwin Locomotive Company. Baldwin had switched production from rolling stock to tanks for the duration, and both Dad and Uncle Buck had become test drivers. The whole family worked at Baldwin. My aunts, uncles, and grandfather all worked as welders and general workers constructing Sherman tanks for the war effort. Since Baldwin was an important production plant in a critical defense industry, most of the workers were exempt from the draft. In fact, some of the jobs were considered so important that the workers holding them weren't eligible for military service. Dad and Uncle Buck were in this exempt category. Therefore, it was a complete surprise when Uncle Buck came home from work one evening and told us that he would not be going back to the plant in the morning. He had enlisted in the Army. In spite of his job classification, Uncle Buck had found a way around the rule and was reporting for induction the next day. The situation at home was now a little different. The whole family was working not just for the war effort, but also to support Uncle Buck at the front. Since things were getting crowded at Grandma's, Dad moved the family to nearby Glen Olden in some new housing that had been constructed for the defense workers at Baldwin. I started school during the war just down the street from where we lived. The whole class participated in air raid drills, scrap drives, and other activities. It was a difficult time for the country. The enemy could be clearly seen, and his intentions were obvious. Everyone seemed to work together for the common good, though I didn't really understand what it meant at the time. Uncle Buck had joined the U.S. Army Rangers and took part in fierce fighting in Italy. Toward the end of the war, Dad moved the family back to New Jersey. We were living in Jersey City next door to where my Uncle Walter and Aunt Muriel and their two daughters lived. Just across the river from our house, you could see the Empire State Building reaching into the sky. There had been a lot of false alarms about the war being over in Europe. Every now and then, someone would get a little trigger-happy, and the bells in the town would start ringing. When VE Day, Victory in Europe, finally did take place, the whole town went crazy. People were crowding into the streets, laughing and yelling. It was the biggest party I had ever seen. But just a few months later on VJ Day, Victory in Japan, the war was completely over, and that party was even bigger. When Uncle Buck returned home, our family went back to Pennsylvania to greet him. Back then, when a man came home from the service, the whole block would turn out to greet him and have a large block party. When you drove into town and got near Uncle Buck's block, you could see banners and signs all over, reading, "Welcome Home, Buck." I've never forgotten those signs. But things weren't all well with Uncle Buck. While in Italy, he had been seriously wounded in the stomach. Though I didn't know it at the time, the Rangers had seen a long period of action against the Germans. In part because of this long stretch of fighting, Buck had some problems in adjusting to civilian life. There was a firehouse in town that sounded its siren every day at noon. We were all used to it, but we quickly learned we had to warn Buck that the siren was going to sound, or he'd take cover or have a case of the shakes. It would be a long time before I would come to understand what had happened to Uncle Buck. But all of this had little lasting effect on a young growing boy in post-war America. Being a rowdy lad, I quickly became interested in sports, playing sandlot football with a neighborhood team. Despite my small stature, I was a feisty kid who could snap the ball as center and run like a son of a bitch. I liked to play center. Even into high school, when I started to fill out, I liked to be in the middle, where the action was. My brother Bob was even slighter than I was and didn't lean towards sports at all. But I wasn't just a musclehead young jock to be. I liked some of the academic aspects of school, too. While I was learning how to play football with the team, I also picked up on playing a musical instrument, the baritone horn. The drum corps of the Jersey City Recreation Department soon had another enthusiastic, but none too skilled, young marcher staggering along under a horn half as big as he was. I strove to be the best, or at least with the best, at everything I did. Hard work paid off with my horn playing. When I was 16, I qualified to join the St. Vincent's Drum and Bugle Corps of Bayonne, New Jersey. Competition with the Corps led to my winning the Tri-State Baritone Bugle Individual Contest in Reading, Pennsylvania, in 1953. As it turned out, playing a horn was to also affect my later Navy career. But horn playing was not the reason I was going to school. I had decided to become a doctor. My first step toward this goal was to enter the college preparatory curriculum at Dickinson High School. My second step was to plan ahead for paying for college. My dad worked very hard for our family, but paying a son's college bill was a little more than he could handle at the time. Since I was already involved in sports, I decided to try for a football and track and field scholarship. In track and field, I had been able to hold my own as a half-mile runner and cross-country runner, as well as competing in the high jump and pole vault. But an injury prevented me from being able to continue in football and track and ended my chances for a scholarship. At the end of the season, I decided to quit school and take a paying job to help my family. Dad helped me get a job working as a truck driver's assistant in February of 1955. I loaded and unloaded trucks, mostly on the piers of New York. Though it was honest work, by that fall, I had decided that it was time for something else. A few summers earlier, a group of friends and I had caught a Saturday afternoon matinee that I would never forget. It was at the Five Corners Orpheum Theater in Jersey City. It was The Frogmen, starring Richard Widmark. No other film I have ever seen impressed me as much as this one did. Here were Navy sailors trained as UDT, or Underwater Demolition Team swimmers, taking on the Japanese during World War II. The teamwork and camaraderie among the swimmers reminded me a little of the best parts of being on a football team, a winning team. One scene that has always stuck with me showed the men rolling off a speeding boat and later being snatched out of the water with a rubber loop. Boy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?